May it please the court, I'm doing very well. I was hoping you'd take the other one up so I get another chance to watch one of these. First point I would like to make, and I'm not going to make any
excuses. Can I just ask you, do you want to reserve a portion of your time for rebuttal?
Maybe 5 minutes.
All right. You have it.
I will advise the court, I've been practicing law now for over 33 years, and this is the first time that I've ever actually been before the appellate court.
Glad to have you today.
Well, please bear with me in this particular matter. A couple of things I wanted to start with, Your Honor. I think the facts of the cases are very well spelled out in the briefs for both the appellant and the appellee. It's very a serious case. It was very aggravated as far as the accident went. A couple of things that are in there, though, or one of the things that is in the Commonwealth's brief that I wanted to point out, at least initially, and I understand Mr. Stoller did not prepare this particular brief. So, I guess it was Ms. Baumgartner who did. There's one reference in there where it says something to the effect that, indeed, Mr. Turner's pipe and baggie in regard to the marijuana was with him. It just makes a comment in there about that. I was actually the trial counsel in this particular case. I tried the case. It was a very difficult case to try. And there was, in fact, a smoking device and a piece of a baggie found in this particular minivan. However, there was no evidence whatsoever that was brought up during the course of the trial that tied that particular evidence to Mr. Turner, other than the fact that he was at some point in the van. So for them to place that in their brief, I think is strictly incorrect. It's not supported by the record of the case. And I did want to point that out just initially in going through all of this. What I do agree with in the Commonwealth in the case, and I guess I was just mentioning this to Mr. Stoller, this must be his day to argue criminal negligence, because I do, in fact, believe that is, in fact, the standard or the biggest issue in the case. I certainly understand the standard of review, which is set out in the briefs. But the biggest issue, again, is, in fact, did the evidence presented at the trial, was it sufficient facts to justify a finding that of criminal negligence? Because all of the felony charges Mr. Turner was convicted of all require an element that be criminal negligence be proven. One of the big factors in this particular case that I think is important is the finding, I guess, that the court made that at one point finds Mr. Turner not guilty of driving under the influence of drugs, but then turns around and says that the fact that there was, in fact, marijuana found in his blood is a factor that he relied on in finding him guilty of the other felony charges. In fact, in the Commonwealth, they rely on, I have it right here, the case of Beck versus Commonwealth in their brief. And in fact, I think that's an interesting case to actually take a look at, because if you read the facts and everything in that particular case, what the Supreme Court in that particular case finds is that the evidence was, I think Mr. Beckman in these facts was only charged with involuntary manslaughter, at least in reading the opinion, that's what it looked like to me. He is charged only with involuntary manslaughter, and they go through the facts in the case, and they say clearly that the evidence was sufficient to find that he was driving under the influence of alcohol. If you take a look at the last paragraph in that particular opinion, it states, even when the evidence shows a level of intoxication lower than necessary to a conviction for violation of code at that time, 18.154, such evidence is germane to the question of criminal negligence. It says, more precisely, the degree of intoxication is a circumstance relevant to a determination of the question whether, in light of all the other circumstances, the act of driving an automobile was such an improper performance of a lawful act as to constitute negligence. And then they cite the standard so gross and culpable as to indicate a callous disregard of human life. But then they close that and they say, but because the evidence was sufficient to show that the defendant was guilty of a violation of 18.1-54 and that this was the proximate cause of the homicide, we need not decide that question. So, I would suggest to the court that the Commonwealth's reliance on that particular paragraph in Beck, I don't think it necessarily decides that particular issue. My position in this particular matter is that to rely on the fact that there was, in fact, THC found in the defendant's blood, but not to the point where he could say that it was that he was under the influence of that. He clearly found him not guilty of driving under the influence of drugs. I think it's inconsistent to go. Yes, ma'am.
Okay, counsel, I'm sorry to interrupt you, but let's assume we agreed with you
right.
in reference to that. We still have some other issues.
Absolutely.
And you acknowledge those, but one of which is that your client was convicted of reckless driving. And
right.
By definition, reckless driving presents an inherently dangerous and substantial risk to life, does it
yes.
not? Okay, so you've got that issue. Then if you look on down, of course, based on the facts of the case with all these children in that van, and you argue that he shouldn't be held responsible or liable as far as gross negligence in reference to failure to secure the children in the seatbelts, because there's really no, the code doesn't actually provide for that, if I'm reading your brief correctly. Can you help me out with that, please?
I'm afraid I don't understand.
For instance, if those children, if he failed to buckle those children or put those children in seatbelts or in appropriate child care seats, what did that not render him negligent or committing gross negligence?
Well, I guess that's what the real issue here is.
Yes, is, so it is, the real
issue. Is the issue is, does that rise to the level of gross negligence as opposed to simple negligence? Because, I mean, you know, there's case after case after case after case where they talk about, you know, certain things are clearly negligent. In the King case, for example, you know, the King case also, you know, where they talk about, you know, driving down the road for a significant period of time with your, you know, at 11 o'clock at night with your lights off. Well, that's clearly against the law, but the Supreme Court has said that does not rise to the level of gross negligence that's necessary for a conviction of involuntary manslaughter. So I guess that's what the issue is. I look at all the cases that the Commonwealth cites in regard to, you know, and there's clearly several cases where either the Court of Appeals or the Supreme Court has talked about individuals that have not secured people in the child seat correctly. And in every single one of them, you have a situation where either the individual was also found to be under the influence of alcohol or drugs, I suppose, or going 100 miles an hour, and, you know, driving 100 miles an hour down the road, you know, trying to evade the police while they did not have a child secured, you know, in any type of, or either one case I looked at, I think the child was sitting, you know, on the floorboard or something along those lines. So I guess that's what, Judge, what your issue is that you're raising is clearly, that's kind of what the issue is. Even excluding the marijuana, I mean, it's still left. There was in fact reckless driving. He was in fact convicted of reckless driving. In fact, the car clearly went off the side of the road to the right. I mean,
it was still going like 55 miles an hour it was off the side of the road, right?
Well, except 55 miles an hour is a speed limit where
but
we were.
But not when you're off the road. Usually by that time you've slowed down
well,
a little bit.
Except your and I understand all that, Your Honor. And it's just, maybe I don't know where each of you, Your Honors, are from. I happen to live about 4 or 5 miles from where this particular accident happened.
On Route 5, right?
Right. In fact, I drove through there again last night on my way back from Chesterfield, where I had court yesterday afternoon. I mean, it's a very narrow road. There's no, you know, there's very little. I mean, at that time, there was next to no shoulder. Now, they put a little shoulder in there since 2011 as part of the bike path. But, I mean, if you know, if through inattention, I mean, there's all sorts of things that could have resulted in this. I understand Mr. Turner didn't testify in the matter, but there's all sorts of things that could have happened. You know, just you glance down at a cell phone, and you initially go off the road, and you overcorrect. Well,
but
those things happen.
Those things maybe by themselves, but don't we have to look at the totality of the circumstances?
Well, absolutely, you have to look at the totality. But my point is that if you take a look at everything here, particularly in light of, I don't think that the marijuana should have been considered in this particular matter. I don't think that the totality rises to the level where you actually have criminal negligence. That's simply my position in the case. I just think if you take everything. And again, I tried the case. I was there, and I understand everything that went on in the courtroom. I simply don't think that without more evidence of intoxication or something, that it rises to that level. That's kind
of. Counsel, do you think we should take into account, as the judge did, his statement when at the hospital before this accident occurred, and he made those comments about, I guess it was his friend, the other woman in the car, pointed out, or maybe her sister, that pointed out, you know, you need to put the child in a safety restraint seat, and he made a comment that clearly showed his disregard, I would submit, and I don't think you would argue that it showed disregard at the time.
I can't argue against that, Your Honor. That's a fact. That's one factor in the case. I mean, there's a lot of little factors in this case, and that's where we are with it.
Well, that's true, but it would appear that the judge considered that, and it showed disregard for the child's safety, or certainly as to following the current laws of the Commonwealth, at the very least, I think.
I'm not going to dispute that, Your Honor.
Thank you.
I mean, I'm trying to maintain some credibility here. It's all, the whole evidence is a cumulative thing, and I understand that. I simply don't think that they all add up to the level that it should have amounted to criminal negligence.
I understand your argument. Okay. Thank you. And you've remained very credible, by the way. You haven't, been it anyway. Thank you.
Well, I have done this for 33 years as far as trying cases, just not in the Court of Appeals.
It shows.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Kelly. You have your rebuttal time. Mr. Stallard.
Good morning again, Your Honors. Craig Stallard on behalf of the Commonwealth. Your Honor, I would direct the Court's attention initially to the actual holding by the trial court. And this is on page 266 of the appendix, specifically where the court is saying, excuse me, I'm starting at line 15, where the court says, it's been mentioned in the, I believe it's pronounced Chung case, 63, Virginia App 1. And that case says, the cumulative effect of a series of connected or independent negligent acts causing a death may be considered in determining if a defendant has exhibited a reckless disregard of human life. And that's what we have in this case. We have a series of interconnected and or independent acts which led to the death of a child. Sometime probably in the morning or early afternoon of August 8th, 2011, Mr. Turner made the willful decision, engaged in the willful act of ingesting illegal drugs, specifically marijuana and probably cocaine. Later that day, he made a statement which expressed his callous disregard for the safety of the child by taking him out of the car seat, displaying it to the mother, who then said, put him back in the car seat. He then said something unpleasant, and said, it's my decision what to do with the child. It's not the police. It's not anybody. It's my choice what to do.
He said it's my child or something
right,
like that. Right,
Your Honor. After that point, he makes the willful decision to drive the vehicle, being impaired, and we know he's impaired based on the expert testimony saying that he still had active THC in his blood system. Now, it wasn't enough to get to the point of convicting him of driving under the influence, because that's a separate statute with different standards of proof. It's certainly an element this court can consider in determining criminal negligence. He was impaired when he got behind the wheel of the vehicle. When he got behind the wheel of the vehicle, he also made the willful omission to not ensure that each of the children in that car were properly restrained. In fact, the two most vulnerable children in that car didn't even have the appropriate gear to which they could be secured in the vehicle. The child safety seat for the three-month-old was legally incapable of doing what it's required to do. The three-year-old did not have a proper seat for that child to be in. So even if he wanted to, they didn't have the means to actually safely restrain these children in the vehicle. At that point, he's driving the vehicle. And then at a point, he makes the willful act and willful decision to drive recklessly. The passenger in the car immediately after the accident says that the driver passed two slower moving vehicles prior to the accident occurring. The truck that saw the car coming around the corner said to himself before the accident occurred, he's not going to make that turn. If it's obvious to a person observing from the outside, this car is clearly driving well beyond the speed limit, if he can't even make the turn. So he's clearly exceeding the speed limit while being impaired, while making sure the children are not being restrained, and by after expressing a callous disregard for the law regarding the safety of the children.
What all is the evidence of the degree of impairment?
We don't know. It's difficult to say what the degree of impairment is. What we do have is the expert's testimony saying that the concentration of THC in the system, I believe, was 0.02. They said that it was active THC. It wasn't the metabolites, so he was still under the influence of THC at the time. And the expert went on to list some of what the side effects of taking THC or marijuana would be, including inattentiveness, inability to determine distance. Even if it's a minimal impairment, it's still an impairment. We do know he's under the influence. We do know it did impair his ability to drive. As the court's already indicated, once he went off the road, he did not slow down. He was still going at least at the speed limit.
It was interesting because the news in the last days of these states that are legalizing marijuana have now come up with a problem, in California being one of them, that they don't have any idea of knowing what the degree of impairment is for marijuana is equivalent to 08, 10, 15, whatever they have at the different stages. But basically, what you have is the doctor says this does affect you somewhat.
Correct.
But the degree, you really don't have any idea what the degree is, do you?
We don't. And a lot of it may have well to do with the fact that marijuana is illegal. Clearly, with alcohol, it's possible to do tests, blood tests, and we can have a pretty certain determination of what 0.08 means, what 0.1 means, and so forth and so on. With marijuana, there's no equivalent studies. And I don't think it's an issue that you can't say he was impaired. It's just that we can't say, as a matter of law, beyond a reasonable doubt, he's so impaired that he's necessarily dangerous.
Why wouldn't this be like you showed up with... You had some alcohol, but you didn't have enough to be convicted of the offense. And so you really don't know whether it had any effect on it at all. Can you even consider it?
I think it's clearly a factor. It was admissible evidence. The court can consider it, give it whatever weight the court believes is appropriate. I mean, I think if it'd be, the equivalent would be like if someone had a 0.03 or a 0.04 blood alcohol content. For some people, that might be significant type of impairment, not legally intoxicated. Other people, it may not.
Well, if you had had an 0.03, could you have used it as evidence against the person unless somebody would have come in and said, what is exactly the effect, and probably the effect on this particular person, of an 0.03? Because you get into the usual factors of male, female, size, weight,
right,
and all, what you eat and all these things.
I believe the short answer is yes. I think the court can consider it. And I think it has to do with, in the context of
so
negligence.
Even if it was only, I don't mean to interrupt you, but even if, follow up on Judge Baumgartner's question, let's say you took... You drank like a quarter of a glass of wine or even just a few sips of wine. You've had some alcohol. There's no way you're anywhere, not even at 0.03, let's
right.
say. You're at 0.02 or 0.01. The court can still consider that.
Well, I think, given your scenario, a couple sips of wine, we're probably not even going to get a register on the BAC meter. I think once we have enough in the system that it can actually register what's there, I think then it's a slightly different scenario. But I think what my position is anyway is that it's a factor amongst others that if you are going to ingest, especially something that's an illegal drug, that it's unknown to how strong it is. I mean, if you have a beer, you generally know how much alcohol is in there. If you smoke some marijuana, you have no idea how strong that is. There's clearly no labeling, obviously. You don't know what kind of impact it's going to have on the person who's using it.
Well, one's legal and the other's not.
Right. But the issue is once doing that and then deciding to drive a car with five children in it who are not properly restrained, I think that's a factor the court can consider when determining whether or not that adds to the amount of negligence going on with the other factors, the not securing them in the vehicle, coupled with the reckless driving, the speeding, the inability to correct after the car goes off the road. I think all of those factors coupled with this is an additional factor. I think, again, standing by itself certainly would not be sufficient.
Would you concede that not having the kids buckled up, if that was the only one of these, you would not have enough for conviction?
I would agree that failing to buckle a child would constitute negligence, but not criminal negligence.
That would not make...
No. In reckless driving by itself, I believe there's also case law that says that by itself does not constitute criminal negligence. But the case law does say you can have multiple negligent acts, which, cumulatively speaking, result in criminal negligence, which is what we have in this case. We have multiple acts of negligence, which clearly result in criminal negligence because each act of negligence compounded the previous one. So by the time we're done...
Would those acts of negligence that you add up have to have some bearing on the manner in which the vehicle was driven? Being unbuckled doesn't have anything to do with how you drive the vehicle.
True.
Speed, if you can use the fact of some consumption, It would. But if can you add into use one of your additional elements, something that didn't have any effect on the manner in which your conduct was that then caused the wreck?
I would agree that not buckling the children in did not have anything to do with how the car is being driven. I will say that the fact the children are not buckled in has to do with one of the proximate causes for their injuries. And for that reason, I think it is a relevant factor that the court can determine and be part of the cumulative analysis. For had they been buckled in, if that negligent act had not occurred, the children may still have suffered some injuries. I think most common sense would say that the injuries would have been much less severe, and all the children likely would have lived. So I think that is a negligent act, which this court needs to consider, even though it did not directly impact the driving. So again, Your Honor, I think the trial court did not err in assessing the evidence before it and finding that the accumulation of all the negligent acts committed by the defendant were sufficient to establish criminal negligence, and that each of the convictions for involuntary manslaughter and child abuse neglect, one with serious injuries, was the correct decision. And if the court has any additional questions, I would ask this court to affirm.
Thank you, Your Honor. Thank you, Mr. Kelly. You have your rebuttal time.
Just briefly, may it please the court, and go back to Judge Baumgartner, your original question to Mr. Stoward. The testimony of both experts in the case was clearly that although there must have been marijuana ingested somewhere between 8, up to 12 hours, that neither one of them could say. I mean, the best that they could say is that it may have had an effect on Mr. Turner. Absolutely none of the evidence established that it did have an effect on Mr. Turner. They just said it would have some effect, but to what degree, there was absolutely no testimony that could establish that. That's what led Judge McGinty to find him not guilty of driving under the influence of drugs. And so, I mean, to answer your question, in a straightforward manner, there simply was no evidence that established how it did, in fact, or if it had any effect whatsoever on Mr. Turner. I'd also like just briefly point out, just in comparing the facts, I mean, the Commonwealth is relying on the Chung case, I suppose, is where they're talking about the cumulative effect. Well, if you take a look at the cumulative, what the cumulative facts were in that particular case, they were pretty aggravated. Number one, you had somebody driving a bus, was actually driving a common carrier, who there was just overwhelming evidence consisting of him yawning, drinking energy drinks, stopping and yelling at people. I mean, there was just, and driving for a long, several hour, like 3 or 4 hour period of time. Plus, there was testimony of him weaving all over the road, crossing. I mean, if you read the facts of that particular case, kind of makes my point in this is that I don't think the facts in this particular case involving Mr. Turner are anywhere near as aggravated as the Chung case. And that's kind of the point that we have to talk about is, they can have cumulative facts that will add up to criminal negligence. I'm simply arguing that the facts in this particular case do not rise to that level. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Kelly. We will greet counsel, and then we will hear Clarence Epps, Jr. versus Commonwealth.